Hey, welcome to the podcast. Today's Voices of Conservation Science from beautiful Bozeman, Montana. We're here in studio Zoom still because of the global pandemic, and we're social distancing like good people. And I'm Chris Guy. I'm your host for today's podcast. And this podcast focuses on people doing science that's then used to conserve natural resources. Today, I am here with Mike Simonatowski, and he is a graduate student at Montana State University in the Department of Ecology. Mike, how are you doing today?
Doing well, Chris. Thanks for having me today.
Good. Let's start off a little bit by you telling us just a little bit about yourself.
Yeah. So like you said, my name is Mike Simonatowski, originally from just outside of Detroit, Michigan, a suburb called Milford. Grew up in that same area and went to school at Michigan State for my undergraduate, like the other members of my family did, kind of a legacy student in that respect, and pursued a fisheries management undergraduate degree at Michigan State there. Before making the big move out west to work in Yellowstone National Park, and now work on research under the Montana Cooperative Fishery Research Unit here at Montana State University.
Excellent. So Michigan State University, then you guys are big fans, then your family. And so when Michigan State plays University of Michigan, it's big deal.
It's a big deal. We always joke, there's neighbors that they sell flags back home. They say a house divided, and it'll be a flag. One half is MSU, one half is U of M. So yeah, it's definitely a big deal. It's a big deal. U of M games and Ohio State University games get so a little contentious, that's for sure.
You've been at Montana State for a little while now, and you're familiar with the Montana State University of Montana rivalry. I mean, that's a pretty big rivalry for here. I mean, does it compare to the Michigan rivalry?
It's much more mundane out here. It is a lot. Let's just say fans can be a lot more aggressive back home about their allegiances. We'll just say that, to put it nicely. Yep. And the only reason that you know, my family's has always loved how I went to MSU for undergrad, and now I'm going to MSU again for graduate school. And they're just happy that the colors of MSU are blue and gold and not blue and mace. Otherwise, we'd probably have an issue. So,
how many students were at Michigan State University when you were going there? Do you know?
Yeah, when I was going to Michigan State, there was 54,000.
Wow.
Undergraduate students. It was nothing to have a class with 500 kids mm-hmm. in a lecture. So that's something I was actually talking with some friends of mine the other day, and my roommate, and was saying that that's one of the things that I think I've enjoyed so much about Montana mm-hmm. State is how much more personal the experience has been, smaller class sizes and such.
Yeah, and we've been talking at the university here about, you know, just what are we going to do with these large classes given the coronavirus and mm-hmm. you know, places like Michigan State are dealing with the same thing when their class sizes are, you know, two times, some of the large classes are two times greater than Montana State University. So mm-hmm. I think there's going to be some big changes in order, certainly for a little while. So, what compelled you, you know, we talked a little about, you know, you growing up outside of Detroit, right? And I was just thinking about Detroit and then this pursuing of the career in conservation. What really compelled you to do that?
Well, you know, kind of, it definitely is in part kind of the cliche answer, right? Where it's like, well, I grew up being able to, you know, recreate and hunt and fish and kind of experience the natural world in that way. And so that definitely was surely a large component of it. However, as I got older, it was a lot more readily apparent to me of just the impacts that we as humans kind of were having on our environment and having, you know, on our ecosystems and stuff. And the Great Lakes is a wonderful place. It's absolutely gorgeous. But there is kind of a litany of issues with the Great Lakes. And so growing up just outside of Detroit, the closest thing about 30 minutes from home being the Detroit River, I mean, it just, the pollution from the steel refineries, the auto manufacturing, and so the water quality issues that, you know, I grew up with dealing with, and closures and consumption advisories and all manners of things like that, you know, really got the gears turned in my head when it came to looking to pursue conservation as a career. And also tied into kind of just the recreational fishing and stuff. I'll never forget the first time I pulled up a lake trout on Lake Michigan with a sea lamprey attached to it. And so it was just like, what is this? You know, this alien looking thing hanging off the side of this fish. And so yeah, you know, just some experiences like that, you know, zebra mussels on the beach and just getting my feet shredded before, you know, by these things. And, you know, kind of stuff like that, you know, really, really piqued my interest and mm-hmm. led me to pursue this. Yep.
Yes. So you had these outdoor experiences that were both positive and negative, if you will. And it sounds like there was a little bit of both of those that were driving you to then go and pursue a degree in your case at Michigan State University in Fish and Wildlife Management. So thinking about, you know, you doing those things, was there a certain event that happened or an individual that was instrumental in getting you interested in conservation or nature?
Yeah, you know, definitely. I, in large part, you know, I kind of have my family and then extended family even beyond that, you know, that you call uncles and grandfathers and stuff like that, that aren't technically blood related to me. But, you know, my grandpa Roland and then my grandfather, on my mom's side of the family, and then my grandfather and my father on his side of the family. You know, they just always had us outside and just grew up fishing and hunting and, you know, just learning to love and appreciate, you know, the natural world and the splendor that's contained within it, you know. And so kind of when it came to getting into school and trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life out of high school, you know, really it wasn't even that long of a like conversation I had with myself. You know, my grandpa always told me, you know, if you do something you truly love and are passionate about it, you'll never work a day in your life. And I know that could be a little bit of a cliche statement, but it's something that stuck with me for my entire life. And when I was trying to figure it out, you know what I mean? I was like, well, mm-hmm. you know, this is the avenue that I want to take.
And so enjoying those natural resources around the Great Lakes, what was it specific? You said fishing and hunting, but were there specific events that you did with your grandparents that really fostered that even more? I'm thinking about maybe a particular trip or something like that.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, every fall and every spring growing up, me and my grandfather and my grandpa Roland, one of my best friends, Michael Lee, that is his grandson, would go fish the runs of salmon in the fall and steelhead in the spring, or add fluvial rainbow trout if there's any West Coast steelhead fishermen listening into this podcast. Okay.
I'm sure there will be. But,
no, I'm just kidding. But yeah, so it's, you know, I dream about those trips for months. I've looked forward to it every single year mm-hmm. growing up. And honestly, it's become one of the things I miss the most about since I've moved out west is not being able to kind of take some of these trips and stuff like that on that side of the family. And then the other thing is we have a cottage on Bois Blanc Island, which is about a mile and a half east of Mackinac Island in the middle of the Straits of Mackinac. And so just we had a 40 something foot sailboat growing up, and we'd spend a month up in the North Channel, we called it. So that's like Georgian Bay up in Lake Huron. And just we go trolling, fishing, camping on all the islands up there. And so it was just kind of this amalgamation of all of these experiences. On my dad's side of the family, we'd always, they have a place on Lake Leelanau, which is in the Leelanau Peninsula of the state. And so we'd go out to the Manitou Islands, Sleeping Bear Dunes, constantly kind of just,
yeah, that's
getting out.
That's awesome. Those memories, I mean, and those times, I mean, what a wonderful foundation for, you know, your, certainly for your life, and then also good foundation for, you know, somebody that's interested in conserving natural resources. So those were obviously the good times, right? You're in a great place. You're in Montana. A lot of people would love to be in your position. You're getting a graduate degree in something that you obviously love from what we've heard so far. But we all know that getting to this point of where you're at in your career right now, your career development, if you will, doesn't come without some hurdles. We all have things we have to face personally that we have to overcome. And did you have any hurdles that kind of stick with you that you've had to overcome to get to this point where you're on this podcast today?
Yeah, you know, definitely. You know, I think everybody has a story, right? And everybody has things that they deal with. And, you know, for me, I think that, you know, the best answer would be, you know, I grew up in a very tight-knit family, and it was separated, like due to a divorce of my parents. And so we were very tight knit, but also like on two different fronts, right? So it was like very tight knit with my dad's side, very tight knit with my mother's side. And so, you know, kind of just dealing with that balancing act, having two younger sisters, and just a lot of, I was very fortunate up until the point I was 15 years old. I had five sets of great grandparents, which, a lot of people don't even have grandparents, you know? So,
right.
But with that, you know, they were aging out as I was hitting my teenage years. And so, you know, we were very, very close, and we did a lot together, working on jobs, doing construction jobs, traveling and vacations, like I was just talking about. And so, you know, a big hurdle for me in moving out to Montana was being so far away from family. You know, it's something that I definitely, that is definitely probably still one of the hardest things I deal with is just missing them, you know, and being that far away and having that separation. But, you know, everybody's pulled for me and, you know, and for us the entire time, and wanted nothing but the best for us, and supported me in every endeavor I've pursued. And so it's been an absolutely amazing, wonderful experience to be out here and now be able to have them come out and visit and experience these parts of the country, these beautiful, beautiful places that otherwise they never would have seen, such as Yellowstone National Park, Glacier National Park, and just kind of Wyoming, Montana as a whole. Yep.
Yeah, that's it's interesting that you bring that, you know, the distance up, because, you know, we faced that when we moved up here. Our family moved from I was at Kansas State University before I came here, and our family was all in Kansas City, Missouri, which was only a couple hours away. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, we move 18, 20 hours away, and it's not insignificant, that disconnect from the family. And I'm not going to say I have regrets. I mean, we've had this is a great place to live, and there's a wonderful opportunities, great place to raise a family and wonderful job. But You know, you don't get to run over for the birthday party of one of the nieces or nephews or, you know, things like that. And so there is a sacrifice might be a strong word, but that's all I can come up with right now. Some people might say, well, geez, you live in Montana. There's not much of a sacrifice. Right. You
know? Yeah. It's like, oh yeah, please tell me more about your sacrifice.
Exactly. So anyway, yeah. But it is real. I understand where you're coming from. It is definitely real. And it sounds like you were very close with your grandparents and, that is another issue, right? As your parents and your grandparents are aging and you're farther away, it's hard to be there at all those times when, you know, they need the help and those kinds of things. So there are definitely trade-offs. So I'm here with Mike Simnatowski, and he is a graduate student at Montana State University in the Department of Ecology. So Mike, we're going to switch gears now and talk about your research. So the first question is just tell me what you're doing. What are you working on?
Yeah, so got an awesome project out here in Montana. It's in northwest Montana, in Glacier National Park and Flathead Lake. It's on a lake called Swan Lake. And the project is looking to identify the spawning locations and subsequently quantify the area of these spawning locations of lake trout in Swan Lake, Montana, which in Swan Lake and in most places out here, lake trout are an invasive species. They are not native, and they're threatening some of the native species. And in Swan Lake, that native species is the bull trout. And so this project is geared towards informing some future suppression efforts for the invasive lake trout in Swan Lake to aid in bull trout recovery and conservation.
And so why are lake trout bad, I guess? Why do we need to remove lake trout? You said to conserve bull trout, but why are they bad?
Mm-hmm. So lake trout are a wonderful fish, right? And they're beautiful. You know, they're beautiful fish. I love.
Right. And speaking of lake trout, where you're from, they're trying to restore lake trout. So that's kind of a dichotomy that you're caught up in. Where you grew up, they're trying to restore lake trout, and now you're working on a project to try and remove lake trout.
Yeah, and that actually transcends into like what I've done kind of career-wise and job-wise. I get a lot of flack from my friends back home because I spent during my undergraduate career, I worked during the summers at Hammond Bay Biological Station on the shores of the lake Huron, doing sea lamprey research for sea lamprey suppression. And so everything I did in undergrad was literally to conserve lake trout. And then I went within the span of 2 months, I went from working at Hammond Bay to conserve lake trout to working in Yellowstone National Park, killing a lot of them. So it was like, yeah, I get that a lot from my friends. You know, they're like, how do you live with yourself? And I was like, I'm fine. You know, I'm okay. They're not supposed to be here, man. You know, it's like, so, but yeah, you know, but so to answer your original question, you know, like I said, they're a wonderful, beautiful fish, but they're not supposed to be out here. And so the major problems are that, you know, invasive species, the lake trout, an example, they typically will exhibit competitive advantages over the native species. And they don't have, a lot of that has to do with the fact that there is not natural predators that evolved to predate upon them to keep their abundances in check that way. Also, that applies to things such as diseases. And that works both ways. They can bring pathogens with them, and then the pathogens out here may not have any effect on them. So with lake trout and bull trout, they're in the same genus. So the genus Salvelinus, and so they're both members of the group of salmonids known as char. And so they also are both pretty long-lived, and they are top-level predators. And so in this system in Swan Lake, that historically had bull trout and West Slope cutthroat trout and the few forage species. You know, it was, everything was working in harmony. And then the lake trout get introduced, and all of a sudden these bull trout have direct competition for space, for food and forage resources, and these different things. So that's those are a few of the big reasons why lake trout are bad, quote unquote, out here. Yep.
Right. And so lake trout I guess they were introduced out here, right? I know a little bit about lake trout in the West here. And so they were introduced by humans, right? And so now they've spread to some areas where we don't want them, and where they go, I guess, then the bull trout populations are collapsing. And so that's the reason for a lake trout suppression type program.
Yep, exactly.
And your project is specifically looking at where lake trout are spawning, and why is that important?
So it's really important, because in order to effectively suppress these populations, you need to be able to target all of the life stages of the fish. And so not only do you need to target, to be able to efficiently target the mature large spawning fish, but also you'd like to target the younger life stages all the way down to the embryonic level. And so there's some really awesome research coming out of Yellowstone National Park that is showing some different methods have been shown to be effective in actually inducing mortality of the lake trout embryos themselves. And so having these bits of knowledge and identifying these spawning locations will increase the efficiency and the effectiveness of a suppression program on the lake trout, because it'll allow for traditional methods such as gill netting, mechanical removal methods like that to be used to target the larger life stages, including the big, large, mature spawning fish, and also kind of pull out the rug, if you will, for the youngest life stages.
And so what are they doing on the to suppress the younger life stages, those embryos? What's the process that you said there was some good work coming out of Yellowstone? What was that?
Mm-hmm. Yep. So they, the big one that they're moving forward with now, it's using what are known as carcass analog pellets. And so if you can imagine, it basically kind of just looks like rabbit food. And so it's like some small kind of rabbit food looking pellets. And it's they have made them using, from what I understand, there's a couple different ways. Part of it being like a fish-based pellet, and another being a soy-based pellet. And what they do is, when you have those spawning locations identified and mapped out, you can go in with these pellets and you can cover that spawning substrate, you know, the rocks and stuff that are on the bottom that all these lake trout eggs are drifting down into, the interstitial spaces between these rocks, and settling and are sheltered from predators and from, you know, wave action that's too violent and things like that. And these pellets will cover the substrate and basically create anoxic conditions. And so the decomposition of the pellets will result in dropping the levels of dissolved oxygen that is found within the interstitial spaces within the spawning substrate, and therefore induce mortality of these lake trout embryos.
And so do you think that's the direction that folks want to go on Swan Lake then eventually? And that's the kind of the ultimate end or goal of where your research is headed?
Yeah, I definitely think so. They, Fish and Wildlife Service up there, and Montana FWP, and the other kind of parties that are involved, Montana Chapter Trout Unlimited and stuff, are really excited about some of this new novel kind of method as a new addition to lake trout suppression methods. Yep.
So I guess along those lines, what is the best thing you could discover as it relates to your research on lake trout and the spawning locations?
Well, So my project is basically using these tags that are internally implanted in Lake Trout. They're acoustic telemetry tags that allow you to track the locations of the fish. And so these tags being in the mature lake trout, you know, you're going to have the locations that these tags are occurring, the locations that you're finding during the spawning season. And then you're going to have the actual amount of suitable spawning substrate found within these locations. And so, you know, I think one of the coolest things that will come out of my project is being able to really hone in on these locations that these trout are using. And so, for example, if the locations of the fish result in an area that's, you know, 1,000 acres or something like that, you know, we can go in and using some other methodologies, some side scan sonar and some things, we can actually find out that, like, hey, of this 1,000 acres, only 100 acres is suitable spawning substrate, and allow you to be much more focused and much more directed with your suppression efforts in within those locations, really maximizing the efficiency and the efficacy and efficiency of the program. Yep.
Yeah, because I could imagine that these suppression programs can get rather expensive, and so you want to be able to, you know, target exactly where the fish are located, or in this case, spawning, because you wouldn't want to, you know, dump the pellets, if you will, or netting in locations where the lake trout aren't even at. So that makes a lot of sense that you really want to drill down on that and find exactly where that habitat is at. So that's the end of the difficult questions, if you will. We have one kind of softball question we like to throw out there. It's kind of interesting what different people pick, but what is your favorite animal, plant, or both?
Yeah. So being a fish guy, you know, I think admittedly, I probably have been told I look too much sometimes by people, and, you know, all my clothes have fish on them and everything else, you know, so everything I own is covered in fish stickers. So
do you ever worry about your, making your hobby and your passion your job? You know, it's like a man.
You know, it's, you know, they say that, like, you know, it's like once you start doing something professionally, yeah, you're not going to be able to, you know, enjoy it so much. It's like people that are fishing guides, for instance, yeah, you know what I mean? Never fish for themselves anymore. They only fish for people, yeah, you know, paying them. And so, you know, it's, I definitely had, you know, maybe some of those concerns going into it, but they've quickly been alleviated. I mean, you know, just the places, you know, I've been able to live and kind of be, you know, it's like you don't work 24/7, 365. You know, I don't think anybody could do that. So in the time off that you do have and stuff, it's like, no, I haven't got sick of it yet. That's for sure. But yeah, but I mean, so as far as animals and plants, I got a couple of them. I'd say both. For animal, like I said, going to be a fish, eastern brook trout. So that's got to be my favorite. It really is. And, you know, a lot of that comes from just growing up in Michigan. You know, brook trout are one of the few native salmonids to the Great Lakes. And so going up into the Upper Peninsula of Michigan and some of these places in Michigan, with these tiny little creeks, you know, spring creeks and these different things, and being able to catch these fish that just have these blue halos and vermiculations down their back and are just beautiful. You know what I mean? I've just always thought brook trout are absolutely gorgeous. You know, and I did say, you know, I haven't said, now that's within their native range, you know, so I will say that kind of,
they are beautiful,
you know, fish, the point, yeah, of everything that we were just talking about, right, here on this interview. That's, but, right, you know, they're beautiful fish and they're also delicious. So it's like, you know, I love having a brook trout dinner every once in a while too. And then a plant would be a fiddlehead fern. And so I've not yet found fiddlehead ferns out in Montana. I don't know if we have or not.
Yeah, I was gonna say I don't know what a fiddlehead fern is.
So you can imagine. So the name isn't trivial. I guess the fiddlehead fern literally looks like the top of a violin or a fiddle, right? That kind of curved top to it with the stem going up to it. And so it's just, yeah, it's a species of fern, and but it is edible. And so you get these little things, and it's like this perfect cross between like asparagus and broccoli. And so it's really, really good. Huh. You know, some of the best meals I've ever had were, you know, a fish out of the creek in the morning, grab a couple, you know, a handful of fiddlehead ferns from the creek bed, take it home, and there's lunch, you know, and it's awesome.
There you go. Well, Mike, this has been a wonderful visit, and thank you for sharing your life with us and taking the time to chat with me today. I wish you the best in your studies at Montana State University and your research on lake trout and Swan Lake. Thanks for listening to today's Voices of Conservation Science, and please spread the word about this podcast.